It is 8:08 in the morning. You are listening to Upfront. I am Kat Brooks. When Nia Wilson was brutally murdered outside of the MacArthur BART station, BART officials responded by proposing a massive expansion of their surveillance system, the magnitude of which exists nowhere else in the country. The community, or at least parts of the community, reacted with swift concern. How would the new surveillance system impact people's privacy? And for some, particularly people of color, how would the new surveillance system increase what is already perceived as an intense experience of racial profiling and criminalization? Here to discuss with me are two folks I enjoy speaking with very much. We have Rashid El-Shabazz, who is a journalist, photographer, historian, and urban and planning community development researcher. Good morning, Rashid.
Good morning, Kat.
And we are also joined by Brian Hofer, who is with the Oakland Privacy Coalition and currently chair of the Oakland Privacy Advisory Commission. Good morning, Brian.
Thanks for having me.
Rashid, I'm going to start with you, and I'm actually going to start with a personal tact. Do you ride BART?
Yes.
Do you feel safe on BART as a black man?
Yes and no. When I ride BART, I am constantly reminded that it's a system that wasn't built for me to ride. Yet as a black man, I exist in it, and I ride within the inner core cities. And so just to paraphrase some chanters back when Charles Hill was murdered by the BART police in 2011, how can they protect and service? BART police just make me nervous. And so each time I see them, I think about Oscar, I think about Nubian Bowles, I think about Salim Tindall, and worry about my own safety.
A survey came out that showed that 2/3 of the people banned from BART are black. Does that surprise you?
No, not at all. And I think it's because, as I said, this is a system that wasn't set up for black people. When BART was created back in the 60s, it was really set up to increase the property values in downtown San Francisco and Oakland and to get white folks from the new suburbs, the new white suburbs, back into the cities. And so it destroyed and displaced people in West Oakland, black folks in West Oakland, Chinese people in Oakland, Chinatown. And just when you think about that geographic structure and how it relates to the inequality, racial and economic, in the Bay Area, then their policing practices just continue that.
And you are actually seeing this sort of tension with the white folks that are using BART to get out of the city and back to the suburbs, and folks that are living sort of in the urban city centers about what protections should exist or not exist on BART. Black folks and other folks, but will often say, you know, police do not make us feel safer. What are things that BART can and should be doing to reduce the criminalization of black folks that are riding the BART station,
wow,
BART trains?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. I'm not sure. You know, I think about how the criminalization often comes from other passengers. And so that's one aspect of it. And so we had, you know, like the I was going to say Bake Sale Betty, Barbecue Betty.
Becky.
Becky. Oh, you know, Becky, Betty. Stay cousins to me. And so I think about how often it originates from other passengers policing black people on BART, and then the police themselves doing that. And so I'm really not sure, like, how to increase that sense of safety. Me, I just, you know, I say Bismillah. Like, I pray before I get on BART. It's... That just makes me feel a little better.
And they have ramped up their fare evasion program, and the vast majority of people that they are
citing are black.
Are black people. Now, that's either because black folks just commit more crimes, or...
Yeah. Yeah, or they're being profiled. I think it's two things. So one, fare evasion is seen as a crime, but it's also a crime of poverty. And so
Thank
if
you
ain't got no money, if you're not able to do the pay, you know, the distance pay, right? And now with people being displaced, now you have to pay more money just to get to where you want to go. I was talking to some young women last week, community college students, who were saying, yeah, I had to hit that little side door. I had to hit that elevator just to be able to get to school or just to get to a grocery store. And so it's another way in which poverty is criminalized. And the assumption that it's the data would show that it's the majority black people being cited. But that's not necessarily who's the majority of people that are evading fares. And I mean, just as an example, Nia Wilson was mentioned earlier. Just days before John Crowell, he slit Nia Wilson's throat, he had got stopped for fare evasion. So it's not something that only black men or black youth are doing.
You I think when I first met you quite some time ago, you were doing organizing and advocacy around the CASA community, particularly for youth, particularly for young people of color. It's not just BART. Public transportation is what young people and young people of color rely on to get around the city, and it continues to be difficult for them in terms of cost, in terms of how they're treated.
Yeah, definitely. So, I mean, when you think about transportation, and I mean, historically, like the civil rights movement in many ways jumped off with Rosa Parks on a bus. And so this issue around transit is huge. It's like where we get, how we get to where we need to go. And in the with young people in particular, because they may not be have a license or they may not have the funds to get a car, they're accessing these different modes of transit. I mean, one interesting thing that's been happening in some different cities is how it's not public transit, but these like Lime bikes and these other the scooters, like young people are also being policed there because they see this as an opportunity to get to where they need to go. And many of them are able-bodied, so they're able to facilitate their travel. And then there's regulations that people are trying to use to also police them. So I think there's the general culture of how we police young people, how society polices young people, but then particularly on public transit, because it's public space and people have to share this with people they may not live in the same communities as, people end up getting treated very negatively.
You're listening to Upfront. I'm Kat Brooks in conversation with Rashid El-Shabazz, journalist, photographer, historian, urban and planning community development researcher, talking about the criminalization of black bodies on public transit systems. I want to turn now to talk a little bit about surveillance, and joining us is Brian Hofer with the Oakland Privacy Coalition and currently chair of the Oakland Privacy Advisory Committee. Mission. Brian, following the Nia Wilson murder, BART released what many of us believed to be a new plan for transit service. What was that plan and why did it? I mean, I got an email from you. There's a meeting tomorrow. Be there.
Right.
What was the concern?
Yeah, we had to send out the SOS, under these jurisdictions that don't have sunshine ordinances. You get the 72-hour Brown Act to try to figure out what the heck's going on. They released information late on a Friday afternoon and vote on a Tuesday morning. What we essentially got was a $50 million plan that had maybe two paragraphs of text trying to describe basically what we were calling another domain awareness center, like we opposed in Oakland. It was based on the same PSIM platform.
For our listeners who haven't been following your career as closely as I have, what was the domain awareness center?
Yeah, that was a joint project between the Port and City of Oakland. It was to include license plate readers, facial recognition software, 700-plus cameras, data sharing with outside federal partners, and kind of all aggregate it into this one system. So the potential for abuse and certainly the powerfulness of that system raised a lot of suspicion. And BART basically wanted to kind of start going down this road. They released what they called a safety plan. And like I said, it was about two paragraphs of text and would have cost about $60 million. So to say that it was that we were insufficiently informed would be an understatement.
What are the dangers of these kinds of systems? I mean, we're talking about the divide, even in commuters, right, for folks who live in the, as air quote, suburbs, because we're going to talk about that in the second half of the hour, because the suburbs are now where people that are being pushed out are living. You're talking to someone from one of these outer areas, just like, listen, 13 youth just did robberies crimes of poverty on the ground. I need to feel safe. I want this. What do you say to those people?
Yeah, it was, not to accuse any TV journalists of only finding one story, but it was pretty amazing how many people they found that were quite willing to trade all privacy interests for the illusion of security. You know, we have all of humanity to show that mass surveillance doesn't combat crime. It might move it down the road, with cameras and displace it a little bit, but it never really solves crime. What we've been working on and what I would say to these people with the ACLU model ordinance that we work on all around California is that we're trying to put reasonable protections into place to protect what's left of our privacy and civil liberties in public spaces, but also get some utility after the equipment. Of course, there's, post hoc evidentiary use from video. We understand that. We're not downplaying concerns that people do have for their safety. No one should be at risk of violence. But the problem that we have seen, again, for all of humanity, is that surveillance is never applied evenly. Ever. There is always a targeted community, you know, no matter what country you've been in, what era, there's always a targeted community. And the genius that I think under this ordinance that we have is that we have very robust reporting metrics that are due every single year for every single piece of equipment. So you have to come back and demonstrate that you've been using it appropriately. Because, you know, like with this Faravision, when it's only 90% black males being arrested, there's just disparate impact. And so our annual reporting metrics that are in play around the Bay Area now are going to show that.
Has BART adopted?
Yeah. So at that exact same meeting that the safety plan was released, we were about a week away from our surveillance ordinance being finished. Granted, it's been a 3-year process. It's you know, it's the first transit agency, and they got a new police chief that we had to get up to speed, so it took a while. But so they now have our ordinance. It's law. They've released a couple policies under it so far. So far it's working as intended, but next year will be the proof in the pudding when the annual reports come out.
Rashid, thoughts?
Yeah, I just want to back up slightly about the adoption of that ordinance. One of the things that was interesting is that I think it was Darwin from the East Bay Express had reported that this was pre-planned. So when after Nia Wilson was murdered and this ordinance comes out, it was actually a plan, or not the ordinance, excuse me, the surveillance network that BART is looking to create. They actually already had that in the works. And so it's one of those interesting times in which BART was able to use a crisis of someone that they may or may not have cared about in order to increase their surveillance.
Right. That's what when I, you listeners can't see, but when I said, you know, many of us believe to be a new system, it came out that they had already been testing pieces of the system without our knowledge.
And that's, you know, I had a lot of great working relationships with the BART staff. You know, like I said, some of them I spent 3 years with. I think most of them were acting in good faith. But I was given zero notice that this was coming to us. And for having spent 3 years with people every other week, specifically addressing surveillance equipment, you know, it was definitely a political opportunity for them to bring this out.
So after, since they've adopted your, you know, y'all's ordinance, I do have to, because one of the things that they were doing that a lot of us were not aware of was license plate reading and then feeding that data into a system that was accessible
to ICE,
to all sorts of outside agencies. Has that come to an end?
Yeah, so that came to an end right when we brought it to their attention. But, you know, just to recap, the board voted unanimously not to install license plate readers, not to turn on data sharing. And the administration went ahead and did it. We still don't know quite
how. When you say the administration, who are you
talking about? The operations and the police folks went and installed license plate readers. Now, this is before Chief Rojas happened. It was not under his watch.
It's okay. We have other stuff to be mad at him about.
one of my colleagues submitted a public record act and goes, what the heck? Why is BART sending data to NCRIC? That's the Fusion Center in San Francisco, where both the FBI's Joint Terrorism Task Force and ICE have access and have offices in that building. And we have a paper trail showing that ICE does query that license plate reader database. So I'm going off memory. 6 or 7 months, they were illegally ignoring their own board's unanimous vote, and they were sending data to ICE where people were presumably at risk of deportation. When we did bring that to Chief Rojas's attention, he immediately had it uninstalled, and he told NCRIC to delete the data.
What about facial recognition software? Any use of that on BART?
Nope. And with one of my famous last-minute Hail Mary negotiations about 10 minutes before the board, we got the staff to agree on a prohibition for facial recognition software. That was our biggest concern. With the size of their readership, you could map so many people in the Bay Area so quickly. I mean, you would have a database of millions within a couple days because the numbers are so high. So that was our biggest concern, is like, we need to stop facial recognition software.
We're going to talk more about this in the second half of our program, but it sort of amazes me that I can go to New York and I can pay $2.75, and I can get it anywhere I want to on the subway line. But here, you're looking upwards of $9, $10, $11 to go round trip. Rashid, from an urban planning perspective, where do we need to be smarter? What do we need to be doing that's better and smarter about designing our public transit system so that they're equitably accessible to all people?
Yeah, I think the pay by distance model is inequitable, and particularly as people are continued, lower income people are continued to be displaced from the inner core. And I think going towards something where it is the day pass or all access and not necessarily by distance. Because if, like, going back, so you mentioned the time that we met at the same time, around the same time Lisa Graham was murdered, was also this battle with MTC to use the federal stimulus money to focus on making more robust transit in the city as opposed to certain expansions. And so that was around the Oakland Airport connector. So they got rid of this bus that would have, only cost $2 for something that cost $6. And so workers that are at the airport making minimum wage are not able to be able to get to work in the same way. It takes more of their income. So I think that's one of the pieces, is just recognizing the structure that was created of BART was not equitable. And then now that people are being pushed out to the suburbs, and if you don't have a car, it's hard to get in suburbs. It's often hard to get to the BART station. And so it just compounds the inequalities. And so, again, I think abolishing that pay by distance is one direction. And I don't know what that does to the bottom line of BART. And then there's also other, I guess, programs that could be created, like the one we did with AC Transit for Peralta students, the Easy Pass, where people as a group pay into this system to be able to have unlimited rides. I think those models, even though it is only for students, that's like some of the ways in which you can make the system more accessible.
And I would be remiss to not do a nod and say that BART did just implement a policy to reduce fares by 20% for low income folks. Yeah. So we know that doesn't get to a lot of our community members. Brian, I feel like every time I turn around, you're shutting down another surveillance system in the Bay Area. What is left that is out there that we need to still be concerned about?
You know, I think your previous guest, the topic was pretty on point. I think sheriffs have been allowed to escape oversight and have quite a few tools at their disposal. And that's something that I would personally going to focus on a little bit more. You know, like my friends at Ella Baker, I'm really glad they're moving in that direction. Our big focus right now is trying to shut off the data pipes to ICE. You know, we're in the age of big data, and when you take private and public surveillance, a lot of these vendors where ICE is getting information now are 100% private, so there's, you know, little to no oversight there. So what we're doing is going around the cities and shopping an ordinance right now. Richmond was the first one to enact it. Berkeley might happen next week, and then we have Oakland and Alameda City, hopefully in February. But basically, if you're selling data or like extreme vetting services, which was Trump's digital Muslim ban, if you're, and now our new model, if you're providing detention facility support. So if you're one of those vendors, you're ineligible for a city or county contract. So it's a boycott. You remember when we met the Oakland Privacy Strategy to slow down the DAC, the Domain Awareness Center, was the anti-nuclear weapons ordinance, right?
Right.
It was the exact same idea. This isn't nothing new or clever. It's just a new target that, you know, right here in the Bay Area, we're creating this tech and supplying the data that are then going out and supporting and profiting off of Trump's xenophobic policies.
I'm not going to let the sheriff off the hook that easy. I want to go back to what kinds of equipment surveillance are being used in the Alameda County Sheriff's Office?
Anything you could imagine. The list of equipment is pages long. Our model has only been enacted at the county level in Santa Clara County, and their sheriff has an awful lot of surveillance equipment as well. But, I mean, you know, between the stingrays, the cell phone trackers, the cell brights that extract data even from encrypted phones, you know, body cameras and license plate readers and all sorts of, you know, little analytics and harvesting machines. Like, the counties, you know, that's where a lot of the money is, and certainly that's where the power is with the sheriff. We are working on a surveillance ordinance with them. We have a working group that I participate on. we're maybe kind of in the middle of our draft. But again, you know, as Jose Bernal was just telling you, like, it's political will. It's not that the Board of Supervisors doesn't have power and authority to say these are our policies and you need to be transparent and give us these reports. It's the political will.
Well, I'm going to ask you the same question, and Rashid, feel free to chime in as we get ready to close out this segment. I could spend a whole segment myself talking into a microphone, listing off the what I call human rights violations that have been perpetrated against our community by Sheriff Greg Ahern and, you know, the Santa Rita jail. Why, from your perspective, do they not rein him in? Why is there no accountability? How can we have 90 in custody deaths and there be no accountability? I mean, none.
My number one guess is the ability to fund an opponent. He's got a war chest of a sizable amount. He goes unchallenged, so he doesn't need to defend his own campaign. And I think he would just run opponents against the other supervisors.
Mm. Any quick thoughts, Rashid?
Yeah, quickly, just thank everybody who wrote me in as sheriff last June. Unfortunately, because I have no law enforcement experience, I wasn't qualified to be able to run for sheriff. And so thinking about how do you find someone that could be a good sheriff that also fits that criteria as well. And just a last random note, talking about transit in the county, the sheriff's department in Alameda County has the contract to police AC transit buses.
It is 8:29 in the morning. You are listening to Upfront. I'm Kat Brooks. We have been in conversation with Rashid El-Shabazz, a journalist, photographer, historian, and urban and planning community development researcher. Thank you for joining us this morning.
My honor.
And Brian Hofer with the Oakland Privacy Coalition and currently chair of the Oakland Privacy Advisory Commission. Thank you for coming in.
Thanks so much, Kat.